You are listening to the For the Rose Tech Podcast, episode 270, the local maximum of gratefulness. Season 6, episode 270 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is November the 26th, 2016. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and eating 40 pounds of turkey in one sitting is my brother James Furlough.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I didn't eat it all by myself, and if we're honest, we didn't finish it. But I'm here in California, where we just had Thanksgiving, and our father raised turkeys, and we... as he calls it, processed one of them the day before. And yeah, it weighed 40 pounds. It was a turkey.
Spectacularly large.
Yeah, pretty huge. Pretty good, too.
Yeah,
delicious.
It's actually, yeah, really good meat.
Yeah.
When well-fed in sort of free range. No, it's free range.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
It had a lot more range than any other turkeys anybody else ate. So.
Yeah. Got free pets. It's
yeah. Good. It was pretty good.
Had a name.
Yeah, made a little bit rough. good stuff.
Yeah, it's good. Good being here. Happy to talk tech.
Before we get into that, I want to know, you saw the Magic Band the other night.
Oh, Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah?
It's like good. I did like it. He's a witty fella.
Yeah.
And Benedict Cucumber's done a good job of branding himself as a smart, witty guy through various different acting roles. And this, you know, continues on that trend. And, man, it's funny. It's cool graphics. You know, it's Inception where it matters.
Right.
Like, the world changing and stuff is pretty neat. Yeah, just funny. But not, like, not Ant-Man funny. It's more witty funny.
Right.
You know, like, Ant-Man's just, like, you're just gonna, I don't know. They're both funny, but a different
Ant-Man's,
type of funny.
Let me say, Ant-Man's a comedy with an action twist. This is this is an action movie with a comedy twist.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But overall, good. Loved all the tie-ins, and, I don't wanna, there's tie-ins. It's good. If you haven't seen it yet, I highly recommend it. It definitely fits in within the universe, and they explain that, and which one was it where it's like Wolverine goes to Asia? What was that one?
Wolverine.
Is that
yeah, it's called Wolverine.
I feel like there was a subtitle too.
I think it's just called The Wolverine.
IMDb. You know how that one's like a side adventure that doesn't really matter?
Well, not only that, but it's like clearly a completely different timeline because he loses his animantium claws and then he has them back in the very next movie.
So it's weird, but it's not like that. This one actually matters.
Right. So, it's part of the larger Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. Trailers, too? Fantastic. Oh, my gosh. Fantastic trailers. Probably one of the better sets of trailers I've seen.
What trailers?
So, let's see. They had Rogue One. They had Power Rangers.
Oh, jeez.
They had... what was the other one? They had a couple really scary ones, or seemed like they would be scary ones, that I wasn't super thrilled about. Oh, my gosh. I'm totally forgetting what the other one was. But there was another good one where I was like, oh, yeah. I totally want to see that one.
Yeah.
But... it's good.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here next to your little pal here.
Yeah.
The Google Home. It's pretty fun. We've been playing with it. I turned the lights red and green to get it festive and had it play some Christmas music for us from Spotify. And it's
now
cool.
It is officially the Christmas season.
Yeah, exactly. So
I had to drive home Diana after Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
And I got in the car and turned on Christmas carols, and she was just like, oh, come, it's still today. And I was like, we ate dinner. I feel like we're already here.
I started telling people Merry Christmas after dinner. I'm like, and that's...
I can only take so much of, like, well, it's not... Yeah, that's all right. It sounds bad, but it's just true. I can only take so much of Christmas carols.
Yeah.
And if I start now, I'll peter out long before Christmas. So I still gotta put it off a couple more weeks.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a balance to all of that, yeah. For sure. But cool little device. You'll be hearing more about it later.
Yeah. I got the recording studio all set up. It's ready to.
Yeah, it looks
ready
good.
To start recording.
Excited for that.
Yeah, definitely. It's awesome stuff. But we're not here to talk about this sort of thing, James. Okay. This week, like every week, we'll be talking about... I'm going to try one more time. And try not to trip over my tongue. This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, I mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, Jim's got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yeah, I founded and work for HPI, but I do not represent HPI or any of their opinions. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club.
Nice. I own part of Skullcandy. Kind of. I'm not actually sure what the state of that is at this point. I've ignored it sufficiently long enough.
Nice.
We'll see what happens. But if you want to get more information about us, you can do that online, specifically at Twitter. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is NextWigan4.
I'm at James Furlow everywhere.
Yeah. Also, if you want more...
Even Xbox Live, did I mention that?
No.
It doesn't matter, I don't have an Xbox, but...
It seems very convenient.
Yeah.
So if you get a
I got the handle. You could probably friend me, right? And I would accept it somehow. Right?
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's gotta be an app. I know you can do that with PlayStation. The PlayStation Network. So if you get a TV, when you get a TV...
Yeah.
Are you getting a...
Probably not.
Oh, dang it. Because you're going to go with
the
PlayStation?
You don't have an Xbox? I don't know.
That's a good point. PlayStation's better. Cool. Yeah, if you want to get more information about the show, everything we talk about this week, any articles that we mention, videos, links, whatever, it'll all be there. And you can just go take a look-see, and furloughbros.com is where to go. Also, if you want to sign up for our weekly newsletter, just throw us your... email address, and we will deliver all that content directly to your inbox once a week.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So, it's cool stuff.
It is cool stuff.
We doing this?
Yeah, we're doing it, man.
All right, man.
Wow, we only took 7 minutes. All right.
Yeah. Okay, so I feel like
the problem, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, is we hung out this afternoon... And we purposely avoided some topics. And I also feel like we talked, you know? Like,
yeah.
We got our catch up in.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was like, oh, I already know the answer to that.
Yeah, because that's the part is people don't realize that's like, well, no, they probably do realize as we talk about random topics. That's the first third 20 minutes of the show is just chatting, warming up. So we're into this. I'm not quite ready to start talking yet, but here I am.
You don't have a choice. You got to talk about Tesla.
I know. So Tesla, turns out this week they closed the deal with SolarCity. So now SolarCity is Tesla.
Yep.
So when Tesla does something with solar panels, that's the idea. But yeah, so this week Tesla announced that they are building a solar system with battery backup so that they can run an entire island off of solar. The Tau microgrid.
Wait, they are or they're going to?
Tesla completed its $2.6 billion. But over the past year, Tesla has installed a microgrid of solar energy plants and batteries that will supply nearly 100% of the power needed for Tau's 600 residents.
Wow.
Project seems intended to show off the potential benefits of SolarCity's acquisition, with Tau's microgrid comprised of 5,328 solar panels from SolarCity and Tesla.
Wow.
Along with 60 Tesla power packs, cool. Battery storages, so that, yeah, they can...
So it's a 10-to-1 ratio, approximately.
Approximately.
Okay. Good to know.
Mm. So, yeah, so this
100-to-1. I can do math. We're good.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so no, it's kind of like, you know, it's about The project and Tao shows the benefit of this. It was funded by the American Samoa and U.S. authorities, including the Department of Interior. Tesla says it will offset the island's use of more than 100,000 gallons of diesel per year, as well as as well as the expense of shipping that fuel in. Yeah, exactly. Well, and the interesting part about that to me is that they use the term more than 109,500 gallons. Like, why give such a specific number and say more than? They give way too many significant digits.
Yeah, seriously, just say more than 100,000.
Yeah,
but and we're gonna talk a little bit more about this when it comes to self-driving cars in a little bit. But it's this idea of things like this will start in places that in little pockets and communities, like, yeah. Okay, big island or small island, we could do it. But you'll also see this now in like retirement communities, right? They'll go 100% solar. We've got battery packs powering the entire place.
Right.
And, or you've got like, maybe not this, but like industrial parks or office complex or something where it'll be like this little pocket has fully adopted, has fully gone over to this new system.
Right.
And it may not be, so it's not going to be the sweeping change necessarily. You're just going to start to see the slow roll.
Right.
And you'll see new construction eventually, right? And so it's like, oh, we have this new housing development. They've gone all solar with batteries.
Right. And the idea there will be, it's kind of a gamble in the early stages, but it's you'll say, yes, it'll be more expensive to build the houses because we have to build the solar panels and the battery packs built in, which means the houses will cost more. But it'll have the selling feature of, oh, by the way, you never have to pay for power.
Yeah. And I mean, and it makes sense here, right? Because they're shipping in fuel. So that cannot be cheap.
Yeah.
So it's like that's an obvious no-brainer. Yeah. And I think it'll become more obvious a no-brainer for others, exactly. Too.
And at 600 people, it's not a giant installation for, you know, a 10,000-person community.
600 people, so that is about 10 solar panels to one.
Yeah.
A little less.
But. Got it. Yes. It's an interesting... I don't know. It's cool. It's exciting because it's just the first... In the first step. And the other thing that is really interesting to me about this is the idea of the distributed power system. Like, that's one of the big advantages, and it'll actually be harder to I think it'll be harder to get adoption of solar panels in communities that already have a power grid, because there's cheap, reliable, efficient power already available.
Yeah, that
makes
sense.
Whereas in communities where that doesn't exist, it'll be, if it's affordable, it'll be really advantageous. So, and what that parallels is the cell towers versus landline internet. Like, why is it that in India and China, especially the rural areas, it's incredibly common for everybody to have a cell phone, but nobody has wired internet? Because wired internet is it's an easier technological challenge. It's the first step, but it's incredibly expensive. Whereas cell phones, once you've done it, once you've invented it, then actually putting it in everybody's hands and setting up a couple of cell towers, pretty easy. And
gotcha.
So I think that you'll see this with solar as well, where it's like in America, it will be more difficult to get us over to solar because we already have stable, efficient, cheap power. Whereas communities that don't have that, this will be a lot cheaper than laying copper and building a power plant.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Tesla's so young and growing so fast that I think that's the biggest concern for its longevity, is it's just, it's hard, it can be difficult to pace. If there a radical change in interest would really hurt the company at this point, but I think the idea that, you know, and that's why people talk about the Solar City acquisition being a risky move. But I think Elon's idea here is now there's definitely places where we can go to market this. Communities that are growing up, haven't built a power plant yet, don't have a stable grid, but have enough resources to invest in solar cells.
Yeah.
and then eventually battery packs, and just like with cell phones, you know. So, it's cool. Like this, is a perfect example.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I like it.
Tesla, king about taking names.
Yeah, it's awesome. Awesome little company you got there, Elon Musk.
Man, making it work. So we're going to stick with the driving theme for a little bit here.
Okay.
Less positive theme, though.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Brooklinen ad. Amazing. We'll just switch that over to Reader View, and it's gone. We talked about that in a previous show, right?
Yeah.
I feel like we did.
You get overwhelmed with Brooklyn ads.
Brooklinen.
Brooklinen, that's what it is.
Yes, the show brought to you by them, apparently. All right, anyways. The title of this one is, Are GPS Apps Messing With Our Brains?
Yes.
The answer is yes, but let's ask about how, okay? And it's something to think about as you hit the road for the holidays. It's an interesting dilemma, one which companies like Tesla and Google are like trying to solve for us, I guess. It starts off with this story about this place in Canada. It's in the far northeast. That their name is, I don't know if I can do this, Igloo Licks.
All right.
Yep. It's a place where it has a bunch of hunters, and it's an ever-changing terrain, very confusing, can be deadly if you get it wrong. And so they actually, part of like the growing up experience is being taught about the environment. And from a topological standpoint.
Okay.
Here's how you navigate this area. Here's how you get from A to B without falling into A prime. And so things like that. They also talk about, so it's like they talk about stars, landmarks, wind patterns, snowdrift, current, animal behavior, and even light. So they do a ton of stuff to help people understand where they are. And then in recent years, GPS kind of came along, and people started using it a little bit more, but they started to run into issues where it was like if the GPS battery died, which sometimes it can because it gets so cold.
Or
just you run into an area where for whatever reason you pop into a ravine and signal's gone, you know, like, oh, okay. They were finding that for some of the younger hunters, it was leading them into mortal danger. For example, someone would follow straight line tracks onto thin ice and fall through. And others would literally freeze to death because they'd get lost and trapped because their GPS unit was breaking. And, issues like that. And so it's one of these things where they were like, well, is this an extreme example of kind of what's happening where people are losing other innate abilities because of GPS? And, you know, their ultimate argument is like, well, no, not really. And this is where I thought it was pretty interesting. I mean, ultimately, it says that we have become navigational idiots. Which I'm like, that's kind of true. And they say it's not necessarily the GPS system itself that's the problem. The issue is actually the maps. And it's talking about Google Maps, Apple Maps, Waze, and other ones. And they do what's called, it's egocentric maps as opposed to allocentric maps.
Okay.
So, egocentric map is where you are the center dot and the screen revolves around you.
Right. Okay.
Okay. They go, whereas allocentric one is one where, well, essentially the map stays the same.
It's the overview.
Yeah. Yeah. True north is always true north, no matter which way. It's like a paper map.
Right. Yeah, it's like on Apple Maps, you hit overview, and it brings you to that view.
Yes, exactly. And so they say that, so that happens. And what's interesting is like for normally for typically allocentric map presentations, they give you meaningful information like town names and maybe like universities and parks and some natural features. They may even have some, you know, there's different color codings that happen. But when you go into direction mode, like most of the time, those things all just kind of they fade away. Right. And so it's just showing you like, here's you, here's the road, turn left.
Right.
You know. And again, it's like and north is wherever north is. Right.
Right. Which some might argue that that's a more efficient presentation because it gets rid of all the superfluous information and it only gives you what you need right before you need it. But
yes, very true. It goes, but here's the issue, the potential, we'd say potential issues because it's only been around for 15 years and the maps haven't been around for that long. But it says that when your phone uses that egocentric view, it says this uses what's called the caudate nucleus in your brain. Okay, and they describe it as like this looping, snake-shaped structure that is heavily involved in movement and closely tied to areas of the brain that respond to simple rewards. All right, so by navigating by map, So it uses that part of your brain. Okay, so it's it involves movement, typically associated with rewards. However, if you're doing it by map, it primarily uses your hippocampus.
Okay.
And that's the area in the center of your brain, which is crucial to spatial memory, autobiographical memory, and our ability to ponder the future. And so essentially what they're saying is by us using these different maps on our phones, primarily we're not using our hippocampus. And it actually goes on later to say, like, and I think you've heard this before, they find people with Alzheimer's have weak or small hippocampuses. Can't buy? And that's why they'll say stuff like work on crossword puzzles and do more like workout problems. That exercises your hippocampus, makes it strong, helps stave off memory loss, and therefore like Alzheimer.
Interesting.
And then, so they're saying like, using a map is an example of a crossword puzzle. It's good for you. And they're like, and we're not practicing that anymore. Of course, some would argue that we are also now traveling much further than people used to before vehicles. And we'll talk more about that later too. And so like even in the olden times, they're like, they didn't really exercise the hippocampus much either. Because they just weren't going that far. The
right.
Directions were pretty easy. Well, about a mile that way.
Yeah.
You know? Though there's some of it. I guess there would be some of it. So they're kind of going in and saying, this is potentially a problem. It goes a lot more into the science, and it talks about rats running around mazes where they're like actually measuring it and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But the takeaway is relying too much on a mapping system is not good for the long term. Plus, it just doesn't help you because you don't create that what do they call a cognitive map in your head, just knowing where things are. Because that was the other one, is that like it allows you to, if you practice mapping the old way, it allows you to take shortcuts later on. And this would probably be the biggest argument for university study too, right? Where it's like if you just learn all the areas and you learn where point A is and where point B is and where point C is, you will be able to easier go from point A to point C.
Right.
Excuse me, because you'll have an idea. And if you've ever like, I don't know if you've done this in some of your business trips, but when you travel to somewhere else and you're like using a map to get around, by that third or fourth day, you've developed that cognitive
right.
map and can go, I think it's over that way. Let's just walk that way for a little bit. I think it's over there. And you get like pretty close to go, yeah, it's, oh yeah, there it is over there.
Right.
You know, I'm sure you've had that moment.
Yeah. Well, like the greatest example of that was when the Boston trip that we went on earlier this year, where Timmy and I we showed up early, Diana showed up late. And by the time Diana showed up, Timmy and I had already kind of worked out that like mental overview of Boston. And so we could just sort of know, oh, okay, we want to go here, it's near this. And we, before we even open up our maps, we're heading in the right direction. And Diana was like, wait a second. You know, just they were like, just come on, don't worry, just, we'll get there. And
yeah, they even said like there's value in getting lost too, because then you kind of get surprised and you become more aware and you get in the problem solving mode.
We used to do that when we were young, and we were like, we would drive around and just like, we would just turn down a random road and be like, you know, as long as we had our sense of direction, we weren't lost. We just didn't know where we were.
Right. Right. And that was always like the distinction that you had to, make. Yeah. I remember that. And you'd be like, I don't know. Just, there's a road. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can get home from here. Yeah, totally. So, they sit there and say, so there's a couple things that you can obviously do to help ward it off. From a user perspective, it's pretty obvious. Just like
look at the overview.
You could do that, but just try not to even use a map if you don't have to.
Ah, yeah. See, but the problem with that is maps are great because they have the traffic information, and that is mission critical in my life.
Fair enough. But then she would argue, we'll just put the map up. Don't do the driving directions. And just have it be your dot with true north,
yeah,
with the traffic patterns on. That, I mean, that in essence is as close as you can get to an allocentric map, while also still knowing where you're at, which is convenient.
It's funny. It's interesting that you would say that. I see where you're going with that, and I'm like,
it's good for your brain.
But that's not how it works, because if I close the map app while I'm driving, then it goes away. Like, and I have to like.
Why would you be changing something on your phone while driving?
Because I'm tracking the traffic.
We would have the traffic on the map.
No. See, this is the problem, though. Like, I close the app. Just so, because I'm not paying attention to it, turn my phone, like, just close the window, and then the app resets, and I open it up, and it's recentered everything, and now I can't see where the traffic is. Whereas the overview will
always... I'm trying to figure out why you're touching your phone to begin with. That's the part that's confused.
No. I turned on my phone,
yep.
Looked at the map,
yep.
And then I turned it off and set it aside.
Oh, why did you do that? I get that's where I got confused. Okay. So I have a little thing where I just put my phone up there and I just see it at all times.
Yeah, mine so don't do that. Well, you see, I'm safe
little,
with my.
You could get a little thing.
I don't engage in distracted driving, James.
I thought you just said you'd like to get an updated map view. When does that happen?
When I'm not being distracted.
When you're not driving. Okay. All right. Anyways, that's a little. Word of the warning, over-reliance on mapping apps using egocentric views. Not the best thing ever. If you can go without the map, do it. Even with traffic information, sorry, you have to deal with that.
It's interesting that you would say that, because one of the reasons why Waze drives me crazy is because it doesn't allow you to easily look at an overview of the map. And that's always my first move is whatever route that,
yeah.
You know, I open up Apple Maps, whatever route it says, I look at the overview and I constantly, I've got the turn by turn on my watch, and then I've got the overview so I can kind of get a general sense of, okay, how quickly do I have to turn? You know, if I turn left, am I making an immediate left right away? Like, do I want to be in the innermost lane?
Right.
And I find that Waze, the fact that I have to, like, it drives me crazy all the time that I use it less than I would because of that.
Mm.
But it's I don't know, that's fascinating. I wonder what that says about me, the fact that I want
you're a control freak.
I want the aloe. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but... yeah, I guess at the very least it would say before you take on a trip, like, try to make it a point to look at the overview, at the very least.
Yeah.
Get that overall sense of your trip. But if you can handle it, just don't even, like, put it in overview mode and don't necessarily do turn by turn.
Right. It's interesting.
It's good for your brain.
I probably won't do that.
Long term, and if it's a long term benefit, we Americans don't do it. But
I know.
You've been warned.
Like I said. Yeah. Thanks for making me feel bad about what I'm going to continue to not do.
You're welcome. That's how we roll.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
GPS.
So, Yeah. So Thanksgiving is awesome.
Yes.
For many reasons. One of them being that
you have an opportunity to sit down and tell your family what you're grateful for and just ponder and be thankful.
Yes. And you know what I'm thankful for? Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, this show, we do a weekly, like, we look for topics to sort of as leap boards for other things we want to talk about. We try to keep it topical. Yeah, there's nothing this week. Like, this real, real shallow week. So I decided that I've been thinking about this idea, and I just kind of want to bring it up. I have no article that goes with this, but I'm going to title this section The Topology of Invention.
The Topology of Invention.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's this analogy for kind of how I see these tech companies and invention and what we're doing and why some things are difficult to design and build on and why other things, you know, what's the difference between innovation, true innovation, and incremental improvement and stuff like that. So this is the idea. So topology is an interesting study of math, but it has a really great real-world analogy that everybody's familiar with, which are those ringed maps that show you elevation.
Yeah.
That's literally
allocentric maps.
There we go.
That show you rings.
Exactly. but the idea being that those rings, we've all seen what a topological map looks like.
Yeah. Topo maps.
Yeah, where those come from is this study of topology in math, which is you have these different graphs at different elevations, and there's all these sorts of true ideas. And one of the difficulties with topological maps is finding what they call a universal pinnacle point.
Okay.
All right.
Universal pinnacle point.
Yeah. So the highest point on the map, basically. So in a real-world analogy of this would be you'd want to find the tallest mountain. And there are different ways that you can kind of go about doing that. One of the easiest ways to do it is just to lay out the entire map and kind of see, okay, which mountain's the tallest. That can be really difficult, though, for a number of reasons mathematically, and it's going to be, in this analogy, it's going to be incredibly difficult. So this is the idea that for most people, most of the time, all we can see is, let's say you're on the ground, you're actually in the forest, and you're trying to find the highest mountain.
Okay.
And you can only see a couple feet in every direction.
Okay.
One strategy to use to find the highest point is to look at where you are and see where the highest, and in the 5 foot circle around you, see the highest point in the 5 feet circle around you.
Uh-huh.
And walk to that point.
Yeah.
Now you can see 5 feet further. And once again, do the same thing.
Yeah.
Moving towards a peak.
Yep. Optimization.
It's a simple optimization problem, and it results in finding a local maximum.
Yep.
So now this is the difficult part with all technology. And I think when we talk about invention, what we do is we're looking for that. Most of these companies, most of the time, year after year, product after product, they're looking for a local maximum. Laptop is a great example. You start with these really big, clunky computers that have very short battery life, if batteries at all, but mostly they're just mobile computers. Yeah, if you think about the first mobile computer, it didn't have a battery pack. It was just a thing you could take with you. The screen was built in, the keyboard was built in, the computer was there. It was enormous and bulky, really expensive, and people could tell it was the future, despite that. And then they brought batteries in. Then they came up with bigger screens. Then they came up with the clamshell design. Then they came up with lighter and bigger and lighter, faster. And now we're at the point.
Lighter.
Yeah, and lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter. And now we're at the point where it's like you have a couple of there. All these different companies are trying to build towards the peak laptop.
Yeah.
And Apple came out with their latest version of the peak laptop, which is this device that has a touch bar at the top of the keyboard,
which I got to play with today.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know if it's worth the extra money for it.
If you need a new Mac Pro, It's a fine upgrade.
It's an okay upgrade.
It's an okay upgrade. I mean
if you're stretching a dollar to make it work, no. I wouldn't get it. It's not crucial. It doesn't change your computing experience.
No, but what I mean is if you were already going, if you need to upgrade, that's what I meant. But like if you're already at the point of like my Mac Pro is so old that it's not working anymore, it's if the keys are broken, whatever, or it's just not slow enough, I need more horsepower.
It's just not slow enough.
Yeah, it's just not fast enough. I need more horsepower. It's a great Mac to upgrade to.
If you're going 15-inch, then yeah, great. Yeah. But if you're doing the 13-inch and you had to choose between the touch bar and no touch bar, man, I might consider a bigger hard drive.
Oh yeah? Interesting.
Yeah. A little faster processor, maybe.
Yeah, no, I can, you know, honestly, I can feel that. I get where you're coming from.
Which actually, in the housing industry, that's the biggest thing that they run up against. Like, new construction, they typically want to add solar panels and smart stuff to it. And like 99.9% of the time, the future homeowner goes, I'd actually rather you add extra square feet.
Yeah.
They go, take the 15 grand you're going to put in solar panels and make the bedroom bigger. 99.9% of the time.
I believe it.
And I now find myself saying that about the computer.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I don't want the new feature. Just make it faster. Give me better storage. Give me the core stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll figure out what to put inside of it.
And the weird part is that you're at this point where it's like you're at a local peak.
Yeah.
You're at the local maximum. They've found the top of the mountain.
Congratulations.
And what I think is interesting is that it's like, you try
and
to
you
find,
can feel it, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like we walked into the Microsoft store to check out the HTC Vive today.
Oh
and,
my gosh!
And
yeah,
while we were there, we opened up the Microsoft the
Surface Pro,
the Surface Pro, which is their clamshell laptop.
Yeah.
And your reaction was, "Well, that's new." Seemed cool before I tried it.
Seemed cool. And once I got my hands on it, I touched it. I was like, oh, that's less cool. The Surface. That.
But yeah, just the
Surface.
Surface. Yeah.
They need to work on that.
The Surface tablet, yeah.
The Surface tablet. I actually think that's cool.
I think so.
I would spend money on that. But the Surface Pro,
Yeah, I agree. Well, and it's like, but the Surface tablet.
That's a different peak.
It's and this is where this is going to extend the analogy. You're now on a mountain range.
Okay.
And what they've found is that there's a mountain nearby. And so why is it that the computer companies excel at tablets?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because it's part of a mountain range. They reached the peak of one mountain, and they're like, hey, there's another peak right over there.
Well, yeah, the Surface Pro, right. It's like they took that five steps, or, you know, they looked at 5 feet and accidentally took five steps down.
Right.
And went, oops, my bad.
Yeah, exactly. And then, and so it's the trick there was that they're looking to how do we use our core advantage here, which is we're at a peak, and extend that into the next thing.
Yeah,
how do we get to the next peak? We don't want to go all the way down into a valley and have
analogy.
To climb again.
We have to
again.
Give this a better name, but yeah, it's a good analogy.
And so they're going to always be looking for the next thing.
Robotech.
Right, there we go. So now
sounds like a good movie.
All right. So now I want to bring out guys. I want to
okay.
ask this question
okay.
about what made guys like Steve Jobs impressive. Because this is what I think. I think most people who sit down in the valley of one of these near a mountain range,
uh-huh.
and it's... Sometimes you realize you're on a steep slope and you get really lucky.
And you get excited and funding comes your way. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. and your name is Evan Spiegel. And but there's these difficult periods where it's almost like, and this is where I think we sort of idolize Steve Jobs, is it was almost like he could stand in the base stand in a valley with an engineer, and the engineer would say, hey, look, I've found something that's going in a different direction than the other local peak that we've already found. I think it's going that direction. What do you think? And it was almost like Steve couldn't see the next step. He couldn't see the next 5 feet. He couldn't see the next 100 feet. He could just see the peak.
Yeah.
And at least that's how it's characterized. Like, he would just sit, and the interesting thing to me was they were working on the touch, for the iPad, the touch tablet.
Yeah.
They were working on the next mountain on the mountain range.
Yeah, yeah.
And he realized, you know, we're in a valley, and there is a completely different peak. And that, or
yeah, it takes some crazy to like, because he saw the rubber banding.
Yeah.
And that was what, at least as the mythology goes.
Yeah, what he claims.
Yeah, that was the trigger for him, which I don't know how much I believe that. But anyways, that was his trigger to go, no, the proper peak is the phone peak.
Yeah.
Let's start walking in this direction.
Right. And
which is crazy to be like, that's what triggered it?
Yeah, I know. And the thing that gets me is that it's like, what he is about this analogy is it's almost like what made Steve Jobs so awesome is that it's almost like he couldn't actually see the peaks. He was just like, we'll build a peak there. And yeah, he could sell a peak. The trick with Steve Jobs, and the reason why it's so impressive, is because he did it once with the iPhone, but there was this other time that he did it with the personal computer. And
well,
Steve Wozniak,
let's be clear, right? I mean, his gift was to, like, he started it with the personal computer for sure. But then it was like he saw it with I don't want to say it, like, was the iPod genuinely a different peak? And it's like, it feels like it is. It was.
Yeah.
And then it was like, was the iPhone a different peak? Was the iPad a different peak?
Say, or was it part of this constellation of ranges that he saw?
Yeah, which I think the answer is yes, which is interesting.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting about the iPod and why it's so, why you could almost consider it this other local peak was because the really astute observation he made was that you could, like, I think what the iPod taught us was that there are other peaks. That before that, everybody was building to build the best personal computer. Before that, okay. And then all of a sudden he said, no, we can build an entire computer, we can make an incredibly successful computer company that revolves around MP3 players.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really, really hoping here that I can blow your mind.
Okay.
If I can open up this article. So, Mark Andreessen.
Yes.
He was interviewed, because it was slow, by The Verge. And he's a VC, invested in lots of successful companies. And anyways, they talked to him. They're talking to him. Okay, yeah, here we go. Essentially, they're asking him questions about robotics and flying cars and other really cool stuff, which we'll talk even more about. But this seems appropriate. He actually says, it has felt in the industry for the last 15 to 20 years like there was no new opportunity to make a new computer company.
Right.
Okay, like he literally was talking about this. And it says, it's like, where are all the other computer companies? The answer is that all of them are in new categories. The drone companies are new computer companies. Self-driving car companies are new computer companies. He goes, it's hardware plus software. And he goes, what's interesting is there are probably more new computer companies in the Valley today than there were since 1982. It's just that the products are all these different sizes, shapes, and descriptions. It's not a laptop. It's a flying machine that does stuff.
Yeah.
Which is how they ultimately get into flying cars.
So this is that's really fascinating, because one of my big points was going to be here that I think I've been a big believer that most of what we've seen in the value of tech companies and the pace of change of tech companies and how it affects other things are based around this core idea that guys who made transistors realized that they could use transistors to make transistors faster and easier. If you build a circuit using transistors, you can do it better. And they used the tools that they built to build better tools for building better transistors. And there was this snowball effect until they got to the first microprocessors, and then they got to the first full-blown processors, yeah, and they got to the first computer, and basically what it was, or they were building rock climbing tools. How do we scale mountains faster?
Yeah.
How do we take... Because what you would find is that there were these things that they were trying to do that you couldn't do through normal human innovation. We were able to go way far down the road of building cars on a massive scale before computers were involved.
Yeah, crazy.
And that was all done by hand, going the next 5 feet. But you might be able to say, hey, I think there's something over here that if we could just do this and build a machine to do it for us, the cars would be way more powerful and more efficient. But nobody could do it. They didn't have the tools to take those big steps.
Yeah.
And the computer automation, like the computer industry, is very much about how do we scale as fast as possible? How do we scale up the side of these topological mountains? How do we move up fast? And they built these toolkits that all of a sudden they said, well, we built all this software to help us design computers, but turns out these are really good at designing cars too if they're slightly modified.
Yeah.
Or these are good at you know, we keep track of all these bits and data and all these big, long lists of information, but turns out it's really good for accounting, too. And so you find these innovations in software that are used for all finding all of these, building towards these other peaks. And that's the trick, is now all of a sudden it's like we've found a bunch of the local peaks in pure computation, whether it's the iPad, the iPhone, the watch, the computer, like these general purpose computation machines. And now software and hardware is looking towards, okay, let's go down into the valleys again.
Yeah.
Using all these tools that we learned from climbing this last set of mountains and see what mountains we can scale. And I think, you know, whether it's super high-powered microprocessors with all sorts of sensors, we're talking about drones, whether it's massive interconnected sensor data arrays for cars, whether it's AI, you know, and all of a sudden being able to revolutionize how health is taken care of and how, you know, lawyering is done and how all these different industries. It's like we scaled this mountain. And in the process, we built a tool set that helps us scale the next mountain even faster and more aggressively, which is pretty exciting if that's true. And
I don't know. Yeah, it's funny. I'm thinking this is our next article, so it kind of like, let's keep this going. They ask Andreessen, like, you know, what do you see as like life changing in the next 10 years? And he goes, well, There's two parts really that we've seen where there's been a huge impact, and then one where it's like not really much of an impact, you know, which kind of comes back to like where are those clusters of hills at. And so he talks about where, you know, there's ones where we know it, right? There's media. He's talking about podcast versus radio, streaming versus broadcast TV. He goes, retail is obviously going through a huge one. Manufacturing is going through one right now. And then he talks about how even cars are going through some rapid productivity changes. And, you know, and he goes, it's characterized by rapidly improving quality, and it's also collapsing prices, and we're just seeing huge productivity growth as right. well. And so those are kind of – and those are some of those areas that you've given examples of. And then he goes, and then you've got this other sector, which is like the exact opposite, where quality is not improving and prices are rising. And there he's like, healthcare is a huge one. Education is a huge one. And he goes, how about this one? He goes, all forms of media are collapsing in price other than textbooks. He goes, they're rising in price exactly the same as college tuition, which is a good illustration of the difference between the two sectors.
That's really an interesting way to interesting observation of that.
Yeah, yeah. Construction, and then he says there's been a lot of conversation recently, but fundamentally it's still wedded. He goes, we're still fundamentally wedded to physical location. He goes, way more than you think we should be at this point with the internet and everything else.
Yeah.
Which is so true. They talk about later on, he goes, it's a joke where it's like, they'll see some posting for a startup that is like, we're creating a transforming communication platform that will reduce all barriers and allow people to work from anywhere in the world. Relocation to San Francisco required. Just like, what the heck?
It's It's really funny.
Like, we see that all the time. And so, like, there you go. But anyways, that's that idea of, which I think is what he gets to, is like, this is exciting, where there are some peaks that, man, they were higher than we ever thought possible.
Right.
There were more clusters closer together than we ever even considered. There are the obvious ones, and we're doing it.
Right.
You know, where you go, this should be a thing. And it's like, it is a thing. Yes. Yeah. That's exciting. And then there's, except for 3D printing, which is kind of this, like, why are you not a thing yet?
And I think that one's interesting because it's like, I think what we found was that we're still, I think what we hit a hill and we realized, okay, there's something here. We're at the base of a mountain and...
Of a hill.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
Yeah. And it's you know, when last year, I remember, like, you know, or 2 years ago, whenever this really started to take off, we talked about it on the show. And my whole thing was...
This year, we were like, it's a thing, it's a thing.
Was it this... I feel like it was... I think it was like 2 years ago. Because I remember saying...
Well, I had read Bold the beginning of this year. And I was like, he's going to be back. Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah.
We had given it DOA, and we were like, no, it's going to be a thing.
And I remember, I would say, I can
wish they got the 3D printer up in the International Space Station
that's
now.
That's true.
So that's like, it's a thing for them.
And I feel...
all 12 of them.
I know. And I feel like this is my thought on it was, I remember saying that I feel like this is the 1986 of, as 1986 was to personal computers, so will be...
What does that mean?
Well, this idea that it was like, kind of in retrospect, it was obvious, but everybody in 1986 was like, nobody wants a personal computer except for these like really small, like, you didn't call them startups because those didn't exist.
Buying one for the novelty of buying one,
right? They weren't particularly useful or anything, and only people that were really into it were getting it.
And
they just didn't understand how
they could justify it as a business expense.
Right. It was overly expensive and of limited use.
Yeah.
And then rapid innovation continued to happen, and all of a sudden, 10 years later, it was
30.
I know.
It was really 10. Yeah. 95 was like an amazing year.
Yeah. Windows 95 was a big deal.
That was it.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, I still think you got a long way on 3D printing. And I think everybody who said it hasn't panned out yet are just like, don't realize how big of a peak that is to climb. Because the biggest problem with 3D printing is that how it actually works is easy. It's the material that's hard.
Yeah.
It's how do you center steel, you know, build a 3D welder that... You know, and the thing is that that's possible. Like, we can do these things. We can build these tools. It's just the building it is complicated. It's hard. This is a hard mountain to climb.
There's not a lot of stuff that we want that's a 6x6x6 inch thing.
Yeah, that's the other part of the problem. But it's, you know, this is all heading towards a direction of... You know, we're climbing towards, we're at the base of this mountain, we're climbing it. You know, and I look at other problems that I think we look at as really unsolvable problems, like medical care, I think is interesting because I think what that is a mountain range. And of different...
Well, that was going to get to my point of like, what's so excited about healthcare and education and construction?
Yeah.
It's like... Yeah, those hills are a little ways off.
Yeah,
is the issue.
They're far away. They're individual
rivers in between. Yeah,
each problem is individually. Yeah, exactly. each problem individually is big. There's a lot of problems. They're not closely related, so they haven't been infiltrated by the tech companies in a big way. They're just...
Well, I think the other issue too, is weird. It's like now that we've seen the tops of these gigantic mountains.
Yeah.
And we're looking over at the other ones now and going, oh my gosh.
They're only at the base of those things. Can you believe that?
I know, but it's even like if they make... I think how some of the stuff how we got lucky with computers was in 1984.
Yeah.
Like they were like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know, and then it was like in 86 or wherever they added multitasking. They went, multitasking!
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! You know, and now our problem is we're up at the peak, and now they do the equivalent of multitasking in the healthcare industry, and we all go, okay. Like, can we keep going? Like, let's get further up the hill now.
Yeah.
Come on. I don't want to have to talk to a human anymore. I just want to be able to put a sensor in my body and have it tell me everything that's going on. Like,
yeah.
Give me the Star Trek thing where, like,
yeah,
you no longer have to do incision cuts. It just kind of, like, it uses magic to heal me.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's what I want now.
It's,
so
it's the TED Talk equivalent. It's the TED Talk of...
I love that one.
Look, I've identified the problem. The problem is people get sick. Now, we as a group, and by that I mean you, have to solve that problem. So just go out and solve it.
Yeah. You know, and I've broken this problem down into two parts.
Yeah.
The first part is identifying the issue. The second part is fixing the issue. And I've already identified the issue. So we're halfway there.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. I love that one. So good. So good. And but I think we run into that problem. And so it's just weird. It's like the hills, it's too big for our britches, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, dude, get excited about the small victories. It's okay. Yeah, some of the medical things, they're genuinely breakthroughs. Yeah, I know that in 10 years, it's not going to be, like, that amazing. But it's amazing for where we are today.
Right.
Just like in 1984, the Mac was amazing for what it was in that day, even though it's a joke now. Just like the NES in 85, 86, somewhere 89. Whatever. Just like the NES, right? That was amazing in the day. And yeah, now we're way beyond it. And laughing at Nintendo.
Yeah.
But maybe they'll switch. Maybe not. but you know what I mean? It's just like you have to appreciate where you are in the moment. And that's hard to do when you've seen the other parts of the map. And you know what's possible.
Exactly. And I think... Yeah.
I mean, because we all know, like, someday we're going to be 3D printing houses. Like, that's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and even if it's not exactly 3D printing, like, you can't think of it as a giant...
It's going to be additive manufacturing of some sort.
Exactly. You can't think of it as a giant 3D printer that will just, like, houses will roll off the assembly line. No, it's each individual component will be built custom-made to what they want in an automated way, and there'll be a lot of hyper-customization that builds to better materials and cheaper materials and faster distribution. And it'll be distributed manufacturing with additive manufacturing along with robotic, you know, invention or intervention. Like, there'll be all these pieces to this much bigger puzzle, and they'll all bring the price down and make it easier for more people to do it until the cost is just the cost of materials and the cost of energy. And and you're like, which we'll continue to try to maximize those peaks too. but it's so easy to see it. It makes the 3D printers that are out there now, which are very cool and fun and as much toys as they are tools, but they're, you're just like, oh, geez, I can see the mountain peak. And I think what's really interesting to me too is when you look at like the Google X Labs and their moonshots. They're not moonshots, they are moonshots by their definition, but they're other mountains. They basically said, look, there's a mountain over there and it's not connected on this mountain range, so we're just going to send explorers to go try to figure that out.
Yeah.
And they'll live off of the mountain peak that we're on, which is Search and, you know, Android. And they'll go do their things. They'll leverage the tools that we have to try to climb those mountains as fast as they can.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, whether it's super fancy things that go in your eyes for the school lenses.
Or
self-driving cars or internet for everybody. You know, they're these things that are other problems that they can see these other peaks. Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's an interesting. Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I like this analogy. And the other, the most optimistic part about this too is that part of the difficulty of topology is sometimes it's very easy to see peaks, and sometimes there can be monsters lingering that nobody can see yet. Entire mountains of, and this is my, like, just, if you're an innovator, if you think that there are other things possible, like, that's because there are. Like, you might be at the base of a molehill, and, you know, good luck to you, And that's kind of a bummer. But sometimes you don't know you're at the base of a monster mountain. And I threw out Evan Spiegel earlier in a derogatory way, but I think that's what happened, because he stumbled upon a mountain and didn't a separate peak in this range of the type of communication we want to have, and he leveraged all the tools that are already out there, and he leveraged everything else, and crossed a short gully but found another mountain peak. And it's amazing how a lot of really smart people who can see a lot of really quote unquote obvious solutions and miss something like that. And I don't know, it's an interesting there should be optimism, because
yeah, that's actually one of the things that Mark Andreessen talks about, is that optimism. And he goes, well, how could I not be? I sit in board meetings or in meetings all day where entrepreneurs paint pictures of the awesome future for me.
Yeah.
And they're brimming with confidence that it can be done. He goes, I can't help but rub off on me.
Yeah.
He goes, and I see all these different things coming together. He goes, it's crazy, super exciting.
Yeah.
Like one of the things he talks about, he says, self-driving cars. He's like, well, my company hasn't invested in one yet, but we're starting to get pitched on it. And it's going to happen. It's like, it's a thing. And he's like, and he goes, and I totally see a future where he goes, and cities are genuinely excited about this, where they get rid of parking lots.
Yeah.
He goes, and you replace them with parks and more buildings. And he's like, and it's all electric. It's all self-driving. He goes, it's quiet. It's peaceful. There's no congestion. It's like, there's some massive set of parking garages on the outskirts of the city that's ugly and no one cares about. And he goes, and you park there, and then a golf cart comes and gets you and takes you into the city.
Right.
And he's like, that's the future. And he's like, and you're going to, that similar idea of, you're going to see that in pockets of places, in different communities. The gated communities are going to take it on. He's like, there's different cities where it's like, thankfully, like in different countries and cities within countries,
man, where
it's like,
where governments can. I never even thought about that. But if you have a gated community, you could just say, oh, we have a parking garage outside of the gated community. Your car drives you up to your house, drops you off, and goes back. Now your garage is part of your house in a legitimate way.
Yep.
And your parking in your driveway is now grass.
Yep.
You just blew my mind. I hadn't even thought about that.
Or is it the way the developers would think about it? We could fit two more houses in here.
Yeah, right?
And power them all off the same power grid. Super interesting. And he goes, and he says, there are governments in other countries that can make that happen.
Right.
It's not a, well, we'll put it to a vote and we'll slowly do it. It's like, no, we're, this is awesome. We are now building this parking garage.
There's a reason why Singapore is the other country that they're testing self-driving cars.
Yes.
Because Singapore can just tell everybody, okay, this is what we're going to do now. And Singapore is a great example of a city-state has a giant congestion parking problem. I mean, this is a great solution for them, and they'll go for it.
Well, and I just think about the amount of noise that we cut down on, and obviously there'd be no traffic, and oh man, it's cool. He does also, he takes on the thing of I thought this was interesting, and you'll we're gonna use this from now on. Smart guy, I would not mind hanging out with him.
Yeah, right.
Sounds like where they're like, well, what about it displacing jobs? These are a bunch of people who used to drive that, well, now they're not. And, they're all going to be unemployed. And I'm, trying to scroll forward as fast as I can. How do you deal with the fact that we're going to have massive unemployment as a result of it? And I thought it was interesting. He's like, yeah, I'm not worried about it. he goes, you'll appreciate this. He goes, the headlines that talk about job growth, he goes, they're misleading. He goes, so when you read something like the U.S. economy created 300,000 jobs last month, you go, wow, that seems like a really small number. He goes, and it's always reported as the net. He goes, but that's not the way to actually think about it. He goes, in reality, the American economy this year created 24.5 million jobs. He goes, that's how many jobs were created. And he goes, and at the same time, we lost 24.2 million jobs. He goes, for a net of 300,000.
Right.
He goes, ton of jobs were lost, but a ton of other different jobs were created.
Right.
He's like, that's the part that we totally are missing out on. And so he's like, no, I'm not worried about it. Yeah, we can go ahead and destroy 5 million jobs. Cool. Because we're going to replace them with other jobs. We're already doing it.
Right.
And I thought that this was interesting. He actually talks about there's a concept called dynamism. I you know what? I remember reading this word to myself and having trouble pronouncing it. So I'm not surprised that it's a dynamism.
Dynamism?
It's dynamism.
How do you spell it?
D-Y-N.
Yeah.
A-M-I-S-M. Too many A's.
Dynamism?
Dynamism.
Dynamism.
Dynamism! There we go. It's the rate of gross creation and destruction of jobs. Economists call it that word. He goes, you know, do you think it's gone up or it's gone down? And he goes, and the interviewer's like, well, I think it's gone up. He goes, wrong. It's actually been falling. And he goes, our economy is actually becoming less dynamic over time, not more. He says, and we're seeing the same thing with startups. They're actually fewer startups are being created each year than they were like 40 years ago. Anyways, his thing that he gets into with this is that the more dynamic your economy is, the more it's changing. He goes, change actually creates opportunities for jobs and to change a job. He goes, if you keep jobs the same, you have less of a chance to move and to grow and to do something different.
Right.
And actually, I see that within HP, right, where I don't make this comment all the time where I'm like, yeah, one of the problems is it's not growing anymore.
Right.
And so to become a manager is stupid hard. Because there's no new growth for which people to shuffle into. So whenever management, the only way a management position opens up is if someone dies or retires.
Right.
Like that's it. And then there's an entire backfill of people waiting who have been working really hard and been good employees for years to get it. And so someone like me, who's still relatively young, and that would be my next step, I'm competing against people who have been waiting for 20 years.
Right.
And I've only been at this, like, ready to take the next step. I guess, let's say I had to be in my position for 2 months. So, for 6 months. Or for 2 years. So, for, 6 months, right?
Right.
So, I'm like, I'm in the way back of line. Now, if I was in a company that was growing and changing, they would be able to fill those slots a lot more rapidly.
Right. They need more managers. So, they're constantly,
And it's this weird thing where it's like, even if they're getting rid of jobs on the other side, as long as it's a net growth, doesn't matter.
Right.
And you're reshuffling chairs all the time, and so it gives people opportunity to move up. And so he's like, it's a good thing that we're doing this and technological change is happening, because we're going to shift chairs and it gives people an opportunity to move on. To which I'm sure the counter argument was, well, what about the guy who was a manager for 20 years and now he's not?
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
Yeah.
You know, that's his that's his capitalism please playing out. So pretty interesting. Let's see here. He does talk about flying cars some, and essentially he's like, yeah, it's totally going to happen. It just makes a lot of sense. It's an easier solution to solve rather than self-driving cars. It's like, because there's less obstacles. There's less things in the way.
Well, it's,
if you will.
So we got to, I can't believe we got this far on the show without bringing it up. So you got to try a drone this week.
Yes.
And part of the fascinating part of it was you tried to crash it into me and it wouldn't let you.
Oh my gosh, it was so awesome. Yeah, so it was the, it was the DJI Mopro or Mopro?
Mavic.
Mavic? Yeah, that's it. I don't know where I got Mopro from. Mavic.
Yeah. You're trying to help that American company that's in disaster mode.
Yeah, so that's the one where the arms fold in, and this thing is like a couple pounds. It could fit in the backpack.
Yeah,
like,
it's tiny.
It's ridiculously awesome. But it's got the 4K camera on it, and yeah, you can try to crash it, but it's ridiculously hard because it has the obstacle avoidance.
Yeah.
The sucker can go up to 45 miles an hour. Oh my gosh, we had to do a flyby, and yeah, it's fast, for sure. It's crazy awesome. But what's interesting about it is I watched him fly it for a couple minutes, and he was like, here, you want to try it? he gave me 30 seconds of instruction, and I was up in the air, moving, doing my thing. And
yeah, not crashing which, by the way, $1,000 drone.
Yeah, exactly. And he was okay with letting me try that. Whereas, like, if you got me into, like, a nice car, man, and I didn't have any driving experience.
Yeah, that's the right? trick. You've never driven before.
I was like, he's like, do you have any drone experience? I'm like, well, technically yes, but I'm going to say no, because this feels different to me.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of drone where, like, when you put it in the air and you let go of the control stick, it's not moving.
Right, it just stays there.
I don't care if there's 25-mile-an-hour wind, it's not moving.
Right.
Which is insanely awesome. And that's actually his whole thing. He's like, for the record, I'm saying humans should not be driving flying cars. They should fly themselves. Like, he goes, I just want to put that out there. He's like, and I think that it can, because it has a lot more degrees of freedom in terms of how you want to do it.
It's amazing when people talk about the idea of congestion in the air and difficulties that come along with it. I'm like, that problem is so much easier to solve than people driving cars. If you were to start from scratch, the last thing you would do at this point is start with people driving vehicles at 70 miles per hour. Like, that's crazy. How would you train that many people? How would you make sure they were proficient? How would you make sure they were safe? If it was an option to have them fly, like, how are you going to find enough space? Like, the idea of flying things in the air and them all kind of, like, being tied together by some sort of a network of FAA, whatever, approved, we're going to all do this, like, that's obviously the way to do it. And you start with drone deliveries and you start saying, we're going to track drone deliveries. You're going to fly over the streets so that you're in a quote unquote safe zone. Yep. We're going to regulate it and everything. And once we prove that there aren't air collisions ever, then we'll just make them a bit bigger and put people inside of them. And eventually, like you said, all those streets will become, either parks or,
yeah,
or more buildings or whatever.
You get so distracted. It's awesome. No, I totally agree with you. And it's exciting. The other thing he does talk about, they're like, well, what's holding it back? Like, what's, like, what do we got to do to make this thing happen? He goes, easy. Battery tech. He's like, that's the number one focus. He's like, the majority of their pitches and stuff when it's related to travel, it's like, it is 100% about batteries. He's like, it's all about getting them to charge faster and to last longer. He's like, which you're like, well, duh. But he's like, no, we're all focused on that. He's like, and this is probably not going to come from some young startup that figures, you know, thinks of it differently. He goes, probably not. It's probably going to be some bigger research place, like a Honeywell, or, which I'm like, I don't know about them, but a Google or some university research lab that... Is it talking to me?
Yeah, okay, Google's about to get all crazy.
Oh, no. Anyways, it has to, like, it's probably going to come from one of those places. And he's like,
Carnegie Mellon, once, MIT.
He's like, but that comes back to that topo idea, where he's like, once we improve batteries and solve that problem, it's like, it's going to reopen a whole bunch of other things that, as of right now, we've said are unclimbable.
Right. Yeah, you can see, because that's the thing, is it's the for whatever reason we're looking at it, we can see the peak. We know it's there.
Flying cars. He goes, that's one of them.
We can't figure out how to climb that mountain yet. And once we do, you'll have a new set of climbing tools that you can use to... You'll have a flying car. You can fly to the top of any mountain peak.
Yeah, which he's like, we just wanted to fly 50 miles and not run out of battery power and crash. He's
right.
Like, that's our current, like, threshold. Which I'm like, oh, that's, dude, 50 miles flying. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
That would change a lot of things. But yeah, so anyway, so he's just like, yeah, flying cars, totally going to happen. Dependent on batteries.
I really want blimps to be the solution, just because I'm a big fan of dirigibles.
It's going to take too long.
Whatever, I'm fine with that.
But anyways, it was a really good interview. If you want to read more about it, we'll have the link. It's going to be called Flying Cars Are Closer Than You Think on furloughbros.com/270. Good interview. It's long.
I mean, it's one of those interviews where they try to pretend like they're the Wired for an article.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get to the end and it's like, this was shortened for content and entertainment. And you're like, shortened? Really?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Did you cut out two sentences?
But it's always fun when you get to to talk to a really smart person who also like has access to other really smart people, and they're trying to paint that vision for him. It's gotta be a weird feeling to be like, he literally is placing bets on the future.
Yeah.
Which that was one of the things they talked about. Like, well, how do you know some of this stuff is going to happen? He goes, honestly, it's timing. He goes, we all thought tablets were a thing when Newton came out.
Yeah.
And he's like, turned out the timing was a little off. But they hit it again later.
Yeah.
He's like, and thankfully it didn't give up, which is, I can't say that about HP, unfortunately. We stink at timing. And we're constantly ahead of the curve. But it's not quite there yet, right? Obviously, we're ahead of the curve.
Right.
And then we give up. And then it comes mainstream. You're like, personal computers, perfect example. Probably the only one that we hit right was printing, and we're still enjoying that particular ride. but hey, you know what? It's a big peak. It's a really big peak.
Yeah.
And so, but anyways, he goes, yeah, we try to invest in such a way where, he goes, and it's hard, or how do I say it? He goes, it's hard when you're in the moment to say, oh, this wasn't it. He's like, because we all thought the Newton was it.
Yeah.
It happened. He goes, it turned out it wasn't. He goes, I feel that way now about a bunch of different things, and because I'm just in the thick of it. And I get excited, just like the founders, because they make it sound like it's happening today. He's like, so we try to invest in such a way where, maybe it's this year. Maybe it's in 5 years. Maybe it's in 10 years, 15, 20. But we really don't know. We do know it's happening. We just don't know when. And so we try to spread out our investment to cover all of it.
Right.
Which I'm like, it's pretty smart, I guess. You got to know when. Yeah. Got to know when. But
got to get lucky every once in a while for those to real payoff.
Yeah, Evan. but anyways, great article. Good read. Good.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
So if you're depressed, read that article. You'll get excited about the future.
So, good times. Good stuff. So, you want to talk about a virtual peak?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, I got to try out the Vive
today
with our father. I was at a Microsoft store, as we hinted at earlier, and I played three different demo thingies, two of which were... Well, one was super lame. The other one, I wish I had longer.
You were rushed.
I was rushed. Yeah. It was cool. I was rushed. And then the other one just was a ton of fun and just didn't last long enough.
Right.
I probably could have played that game for hours. It was like a long bow. We'll talk about that one. It was a long bow where it's castle defense, essentially. You got guys attacking your castle. You've got a long bow and you got to try to shoot them before they get to your gate and eventually break into your gate if it gets that far. The demo doesn't last long enough where if you didn't kill a single guy, I don't think you would lose. I get that feeling.
Yeah.
It would be close, but like, yeah. Anyways, so it's super fun. That's one where you've got the circular controllers. They've got the kind of the lighthouses on the ceiling so you can move around. It's a, 10 by 15?
Yeah, it's a room scale experience.
Room scale experience. So yeah, so you're moving around, which you don't have to move around at all for the longbow one, and that's probably the most fun one, which is probably what's good about the other two. They let you experience moving around the room. Like that first one, you're just like hitting stuff around the edge, and it's just to like walk around the room. I'm like, okay, I get it.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed by that one because it's, I mean, yeah, it's, it'll let you know you can walk around it, but I feel like there are, I don't know, there, the other, I was, they had a couple of other ones, like the one I mentioned that where you're like under the water and you're like on a shipwreck is neat because you kind of walk around the ship and you look down and you look over the edge and all of a sudden there's a whale swimming by you and it's enormous and you like see its eye and it's like, you know, and I feel like to get the experience of scale and mobility, there were really good experiences that they had. The one that you had, I thought was dumb. I'm really surprised they weren't discouraging it.
Yeah, I thought that was weird too. But anyways, so played it. The longbow one's super fun because it like you shoot an arrow and you're trying to shoot these guys. Super good. Our dad played that one as well, and he has. Has hunting experience
with a bow and arrow specifically?
Has he?
I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay.
I think he was a lot younger.
Oh yeah, maybe. Well, just he's shot. I mean, he's hunted. Whatever. And it was very obvious, very quick. Like,
holy cow!
It was like because I played it, and well, okay. For starters, we watched a kid play it.
Yeah.
Who was horrible.
Really bad.
Oh my gosh. You're just like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a he has trouble coordinating issue. That, like, that wasn't it. It's just something else. Like, just bad. He couldn't hit, guys. It was pretty funny. and then I got and played it. And I'm not a great shot, but, you know, I'm good enough to adjust. Yeah, well,
to give
out
context, to paint a bit of a word picture, this kid that we were watching, the enemies would be at his gate, knocking at his gate, and so they'd be stationary, and he'd fire off, like, six arrows, and the sixth one would hit, and all the other ones would miss. Like, you, they'd be moving, and it would take you one, two, maybe three arrows to hit the guy, but you got him eventually before they got to your gate.
Yeah, yeah, and I struggled with balloons, I'll admit, because they seem to, not only do they rise, but they rise at an accelerating pace.
Right.
As I finally figured that out.
So you really got to lead them to hit them.
Really got to lead them, and they're far away. They're genuinely far away, and that's hard to pick up. But anyways, but the people was okay. But I did all right, felt pretty good about it, I was like, all right, yeah, yeah, I rocked it. Our Tad gets up there. And it's like, he shoots, goes, oh, okay, I get it. And
well, it was funny, too, because he's like, it took him longer than anybody else to figure out, like, how to notch the arrow into the bow and get it to work. And then he fires
it. It was funny, like, that was actually, like, it was like, okay, you pick up the bow. So, like, he puts his hand down, and nothing happens. We're like, well, you gotta pull the trigger to grab it. It's like, oh, okay. Like, he does not game.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever gamed in his life.
I know.
Like, that's, like, the extent that we're talking about. So he, oh, okay. And so he picks it up. And then he's like, now you gotta do your arrow. And he, like, he tries to, like, it's hard to describe what he wants to do, but he, like, he puts his arm back right away. Doesn't notch the arrow. It's like, it's not working. Like, we gotta notch the arrow. He's like, oh, okay. Yeah. So he's like, we're training him, teaching him how to play video games.
Yeah.
Right? And then he, like you said, he shoots one, and that's where, you know, it clicks for him. He goes, ah, I get it.
Yeah.
Right? And you're like, yeah, it's like an arrow. It's virtual reality. It's like, how would you do this in real life? And, oh my gosh, he's a good shot.
It's just, the first guy comes around the corner, and he, like, comes at him, he shoots one arrow, and he shoots a second arrow and hits him. You're like, okay, that was as good
normal
as anybody else. And then the next guy comes around, and he shoots him, and he hits him. And then he shoots him, and he hits him. Then a guy comes around with a helmet, and he shoots him, and he hits him. And then
oh my gosh. Well, for me, it was, I struggled with the one guy who, he had, not only did he have his sword, but he had a shield, and would actively try to block you. And he hit on the first shot, like, just right in the face.
Yeah,
like, just whoa.
Yeah.
And for us, and by that time, you're like, whoa, he's pretty good. And there was more than once where it was like, everyone's dead. Like,
yeah, just,
what do I do now?
Yeah, because for everybody else, it took long enough where the next wave had started. But he'd kill everybody with the first shot. And there was one time where, like, you'd be lucky. The one kid never hit a single balloon. You'd hit one balloon when three would pop. And Dad would, he'd hit the first guy, he'd hit the first balloon, he'd hit the second balloon, and then the third balloon had raised enough by that point where he'd pause, hit the third balloon. Okay, where's the next wave? Like, what the?
Well, and then he had that one guy who was like a jumping, bouncing dude.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, he was aiming at it, and he was trying, and it was like, it's as far away as the dudes can get.
Yeah.
I never hit somebody that far away. I finally got to a point where, like, I have to wait for him to get closer because I know I can't hit him. Why waste my arrows? Which didn't matter. But anyways, but he was aiming far away from him. And I remember you and I were both like, he's way too low. He's way too low. He's not going to hit him.
Aim higher. Aim higher.
And like, we started talking. And he just does this fight adjustment, shoots it, boom, nails him.
Yeah, way off in the distance.
And it was like, this was like the 10th one in a row.
Yeah.
He just, I think after that initial figure it out, I think he only missed once.
I know.
It was ridiculous.
And it was funny because the woman who was like doing the demo and everything.
Yeah.
She's watched a thousand people do this thing, and she, when he hit that one, she was like, whoa.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. Which I like. Yeah, no, super impressive. Which I think just speaks to some of the power of virtual reality.
Right.
Right? You have someone who's never played before. I mean, it's pretty simple mechanics, but also lifelike mechanics.
Right.
And, yeah, that game actually trying to play with a controller would be stupid hard.
Really hard,
Well, you wouldn't have the pullback. You would just have the little cursor and you wouldn't even, I don't know, it'd be hard.
Well, it'd be like bow hunting with any game where it's like the big challenge is the arrow falls. So, like, normally with a gun, the bullet's going to go right where the crosshairs are, but with a, you know, in a video game, but with a bow, you're like, if you're far off, you got to aim up high, and you're just kind of going to get good at
it. But it would be
that,
like, you don't get crosshairs, sorry.
Right, exactly.
You know,
and that's the other thing with this, is there's no crosshairs.
There's no crosshairs.
Because you can adjust where the bow is and where you're holding
it. You got the arrow right next to your face.
Right, so you can look over it. The arrow. It's It reminds me of my first experience with virtual reality like 3 or 4 years ago. And I remember telling you about it because the big thing, it was this really simple demo with the original Oculus Rift and the Razer motion controllers at the time. And it was just sitting in this gun range, and I would sit there and you could dual wield guns. So you could shoot at multiple targets at the same time. And the moment for me where it blew my mind was I'm left-eyed, so I tend to close my eye and look over the barrel. And you'd have these two guns, like, which one are you supposed to look over? And when I realized I could close my left eye, and all of a sudden I was looking over my left barrel, and I could close my right eye, and all of a sudden I was looking over, or no, reverse it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I could look one eye at a time, and everything adjusted appropriately, and all of a sudden my aim was as good as it is in real life. I had this mind-blowing moment of, like, whoa, this is like virtually real, you know? It's just like, it felt real, and you could see that moment with Dad playing the game where it's like, he knows how to shoot a bow. So it was like, oh, okay. So I just aim. Okay, I get it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What?
Which is funny. He did laugh at himself because at one point in time he stepped over this wall while playing mini golf and laughed at himself. He's like, why am I stepping over this wall?
There's no wall here.
And yeah, which is like, oh man, it was fun watching someone for the first time kind of go through an experience and excel at it. And yeah, just, it's cool. It's the future. The room scale is the way to go, I think.
Yeah,
having done that now, you know, I'm the PlayStation VR is fun.
Yeah, it's a great toy. It's a pretty good introduction. But you gotta be into video games, and it's an introduction. It's definitely not the future.
Yeah, that room scale, man. It also gets me excited for AR, I think.
Yeah.
Just knowing where that's headed.
And one of the things that I was watching videos on this stuff earlier today, and it was like, where you'd have somebody with a VR headset on doing sculpting and painting, and what they were showing was a video of the person. And what they were sculpting and painting in VR was like, so they were just superimposing, basically augmenting the reality of this video feed, so you could see what they saw from a different angle. And I was just like, that's so much cooler than like watching from the person's perspective. Like this stuff is, I don't know, we're barreling down a fun path. And actually some good articles about it this week. Number one, everybody's kind of looking at Valve as they've clearly shown what they want to be. You know, we've talked about this idea of, like, how do you be the software for hardware? How do you get hardware that all sort of cross-communicates and everything is universal? Well, last week, Valve announced that they were going to be bringing their Steam VR software, which, for those of you who don't know what Steam VR is it's basically just a software store where you can download, buy apps, and they've built one specifically for VR to allow you to distribute, to allow developers to distribute their VR games for users to easily turn it on and have a world to play in. They partner with HTC to develop and build the Vive. And they announced last week that they're bringing their Steam VR software to both Linux and Apple.
Wow.
Apple doesn't have all computer hardware powerful enough to run it, so it's sort of a we'll meet you there, Apple, once you catch up. And Linux, you can build those computers, but there's still a question of, now Steam software works on Linux, but none of the VR games are built for Linux. So there's this, it's a chicken and the egg thing, and Valve's basically saying, hey, when people are ready to make the move to these platforms, we'll be there. And the other big thing that they did and they announced this week was that now that Oculus has their hand controllers, not just the headset that they're launching, they're saying, yeah, we're going to fully support Oculus software from a software perspective as well. So right now Oculus has they have exclusive games and stuff in their little software world. Valve saying, no exclusives, no nothing. We're not pushing any type of hardware. We want to be the software store for VR.
Huh.
We want to be the OS for VR. And they're making a pretty good push into it because they've become an incredibly wealthy company being the best digital store for video games, and they want to be that for VR as well.
I don't blame them.
And if they play their cards right, it's an even bigger market. If they can actually be a not just a digital store for VR games, but a digital store for VR, and whether it's, you know, engineering tools or artist tools or whatever, that'd be a pretty good business. So they're all up in that. We'll be paying attention to this company as time goes forward.
Wow, sounds like it. Huh. Very cool. Very cool. Kind of related to that, I saw this article that was entitled "Murder in Virtual Reality Should Be Illegal."
Okay.
It's a pretty uplifting thing. but essentially it's saying that virtual reality is super lifelike, and if you get used to murdering people in virtual reality, you will be okay with murdering people in real reality.
Interesting.
Therefore, we should ban all forms of murder in virtual reality.
So, A, that will never happen.
Yep.
B, have you watched the show Westworld?
No.
Okay. It's pretty good. It's on HBO.
Okay.
What's
it about?
It's about this. So basically, it's based off of a Michael Crichton movie that was made in the late 1980s, where it's this it's a theme park where all of the animatronics are so lifelike you can't tell the difference between them and not real people.
I might watch this, no spoilers, but anyways.
So the basic premise is that the people are safe, but they can kill people and they can kill the animatronics in the park.
Interesting.
And it's incredibly lifelike. Well, this one animatronic goes a little bit haywire. It's Michael Crichton, so it's, you know, it goes Jurassic Park on them, basically.
Wow.
And this TV show is based off of its namesake, written by Christopher Nolan's brother, who helped write Batman and Inception.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty solid
Mike
so
Nolan.
Far. Yeah,
I just made that up.
But that's funny. It's better than being known as Chris Nolan's brother. Actually, it's a made up name, but it's your own made up name. But what's interesting to me about this world is one of the things that they explore is these are incredibly lifelike animatronics. I mean, there we go. The idea is that these animatronics, it was cheaper to make them. This society has gotten super good at like 3D printing organs and like muscles and everything. And for the purpose of keeping people healthy and alive. And so they got so good at it that it was cheaper to make these animatronics out of living tissue and organs than it was to make them out of robotics. And so, like, when you shoot them, it's like shooting flesh and blood.
Weird.
Yeah, and the only part that's left that's animatronic in a traditional sense is that they're programmable brains.
Huh.
But
weird.
Yeah. But they're, like, fleshy brains. If you shoot them in the brain, they die until they get fixed and then turned back on. It's a weird, but it brings up that moral question of like, when you do this in this real world, like, are you, if you sleep with somebody with one of the animatronics, are you cheating on the person that you're married to? It's just an animatronic. Like it's, if you kill somebody, is that murder? Are you exercising some weird dark compulsion? Like what does that actually mean? And what does that turn you into?
That's weird. Okay, I gotta try to. All right, I can do this. For the "is it cheating" question,
yeah.
Depending on who you follow, so like for myself, I would follow what the Bible says. The answer would be yes.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm trying to remember what the answer is for murder, though. I guess, you know, if you wished someone would die or ill would happen to them, that's probably bad.
Yeah.
Now, does it count if it's towards
it's
like an animal?
It's weird to me because to me it's
robot.
It's
for another human being.
To me, I would sit there and be like, I don't know. Like,
it's probably yes on the cheating part of it because you're actually you are hurting another person your significant other by saying you weren't good enough. I'm you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's that side of it. The murdering piece, that's different, because you're not directly hurting anybody or saying, you know what I mean? Like, that's weird. Yeah. I wanted to kill you, but I didn't. I killed this koala bear instead.
Yeah. As a piece of art, this show is a pretty good questioning of that very thing. Because it's like...
Westworld?
Because it brings it to the very extreme, like, end goal, where it's saying, no, it's actually, like, flesh and blood and the only thing that
it's even more than the Matrix, right?
If you
kill someone in Matrix, do they die in real life?
Right.
Yes.
Well, the only thing that these animatronics lack...
yes. Technically, yes, depending on how you...
See, the only thing these animatronics lack is a true sense of self, a consciousness in the traditional sense.
What is life?
Yeah. Well, that's you know what? I don't want to spoil the show.
Sounds good.
They do a great job of laying that out in a really compelling way and being like,
is that a watch it with your spouse type of thing, or should I just go solo on it?
Your spouse?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Okay.
You might want to watch the first episode.
Right. Well, is there a lot of crime solving involved? Because if she's into that.
Yeah.
She'll put up with a lot if there's a police officer and crime solving involved.
Nah, there's not. There's not really in this one.
Good to know. Cool. I don't have to wait around for her. Cool.
But all right. It is a... Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, those are some interesting questions, which I... Obviously, through this, as this article, and I guess through this TV show indirectly, people are starting to question it and say, like, what are boundaries and lines that we should watch out for?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's this weird, like, technically, despite video games and movies becoming more violent over time, crime rates are down.
Yeah.
But we also have increased the more heinous types of crimes, right? You know what I mean? Like, overall numbers down, but the frequency of the really bad ones seem to be higher.
Well,
we also have measurement problems there.
I mean, there's huge measurement issues, which if you ignore it for the sake of political convenience is just that. That's fine. You're allowed to do that. But there are undeniable problems with the measurement. And the other issue is cause and effect. Like,
That's what we're trying to answer.
Right, and the idea...
Nature versus nurture.
Yeah. No, not even that, but it's just like, what is... If there are cases of more heinous violence, is it the media, covering it more intensely that inspires other people, which is one argument that's made? Is it, you know, violent video games, which is an argument that's made in regular... argued against? Is it other, there's so many different moving targets here, and I think that, you know, to me, I'm just like, people pushed so hard with Grand Theft Auto 2 that it was this horrifying, violent video game, and that it would ruin America's youth, and nothing happened, and then then Grand Theft Auto 3 came out, and they made the same argument again, and short term, nothing happened. And, you know, there's no psychologists that are saying, oh, this person became fine with stealing cars because they played Grand Theft Auto. There's no credible science saying that. And so you cried wolf enough where I think a lot of the people that are now...
Other than we do know people who have committed recent mass murders were big-time gamers. I mean, so we know that.
Well, yeah, the big question is, what are psychologists attributing it to?
Clearly correlated, but is it causated?
Exactly.
That's the question. Which, even the fact to say they're correlated is enough to say you should probably not do it.
Well, I just don't think it's...
And, which, by the way, is a different argument than saying, should you make it illegal or not? I think the answer to that is an obvious no. It's more of a, should you or your kids participate in it?
Well, yeah, but... Okay, so...
I just want to clarify
okay.
That I'm not talking about making laws about it. It's just, should you participate?
One of the classic issues that video games always do to sidestep is you never fight a foreign not never, but you rarely ever fight a foreign army. You always fight Nazi zombies. So it's like this ultra evil, farcical thing. So it's okay to quote unquote kill them. And then even games where, like Battlefield 1, Zero Punctuation did a fantastic review of that game, in that his entire complaint is that what was so exciting was that there is even more so than the difference between World War II, the moral ambiguity of who was right and who was wrong in World War I is incredibly confusing. It was a lot of just really young kids going out into the battlefield and shooting at each other, and they didn't know why, and there wasn't like this evil empire that was the Nazis. You know, it was just, you know, the powerful scene. And the game never deals with that. It's always portrayed as the non-Germans were the good guys and the Germans were evil. You know, so my question is, it's like games already try to walk on that side of what is killing, what is murder. How do you keep it so it's not just, you know, because that's something that games don't really deal with, is trying to put you into a position of, like, really heightening the life of one person and making them a morally ambiguous case and then telling you to kill them. Like, or that's not, you know, and it's always faceless villains. You get a caricature of murder in most of modern video games.
Okay.
To begin with. So my question is, where's that line of, well, it's clearly okay to shoot zombie Nazi robots, but it's not okay to shoot, you know, the virtual mother of this family. You know, for one, seems really clearly probably shouldn't be playing that game for, you know, at least until you're 18. Uh-huh. Maybe not after that. Whereas the other one's like, you know, why is it okay to squish a mushroom as Mario? Like, where is the line, I guess, is my question, in these games?
Yeah, and I would say a lot of it has to do with, and I mean, I haven't thought deeply or researched a lot of it, so I'm kind of talking off the cuff here.
That's all right. I'll judge you harshly based on what you say.
Yeah, I appreciate it. There's human life is different than other life, in my opinion. So zombies, totally cool. Mushrooms, totally cool. Goombas, totally cool. you know, that's one thing. That's why we, in real life, people go hunting for animals. You know, but not for humans, because human life is separate and different than animal life, which I fully understand, too, that there are people who would say, no, animal life is just as valuable as human life. In which case, I would go, cool, you would have a more extreme person, you know, viewpoint than me. Now, in terms of pitting it against, you know, Nazis, maybe there's a little bit of an issue there.
Or Battlefront. What if it's, you know, it's a Star Wars game where it's Stormtroopers versus Rebels, you know? And which, just in the naming convention, is it?
Yeah, I know, it's confusing. Well, and I think about, like, this archery game that we played today. They're like little drawn people.
Yeah, they're almost stick figures.
Clearly not real, but yeah, stick figures, but they represent people.
You know, and honestly, what I think is really interesting about that game is everything else about it has different layers of heightened reality, where it's like the fire is very, like, is very stylized. The people are like thick stick figures and stylized, but their helmets and their shields are like really textured and look really realistic.
I noticed that.
And they're 3D. There was definitely, they were playing with the how real should everything be in here, which I thought was a really interesting stylistic choice, because it clearly wasn't just a graphics limitations and a pure art style choice. They were questioning how real
can you make. I think this is something that content creators are definitely going to wrestle with. And you know, just as well as I do, that eventually they're going to come out with, somewhere where you are killing people, and it's going to be good graphics, and it's going to be in VR, and there will be an uproar of some sort. And
Grant, I'm calling it now. I'm calling my shot now. Grand Theft Auto 7.
Yeah,
That's the one that will cross the line into...
Yeah, because killing aliens, that's totally fine. We don't have a problem with that, apparently. And so.
Yeah. And they'll justify it in that game as saying, well, these are caricatures of real people. Yes, yeah. They look like real people, but no one would expect real people to act the way that these people act. So they're clearly not. And you're like, that's not... You just drove over a random person on the sidewalk. That doesn't... What are you talking about, caricatures?
Yeah. Well, a normal person wouldn't walk that way.
Exactly. Look, we have their backstory. We can tell you what it is, and you'll know that this is not a real person based on their backstory.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So anyways, it's something that we're definitely gonna have to deal with, and I think we're just starting down that track. But like you pointed out, they've been dealing with it.
Yeah,
as I just, it just gets louder and more interesting every time it gets a little bit more louder or more realistic.
Yeah, it's definitely a, I don't know, I think you're like, I think it's interesting that all of this is somewhat idle conversation, because it's like, you can do what you're going to do with your own family, but obviously this will not be idle. Like, it's not like we're going to...
Clearly.
We're going to get to the point where it'll be too easy for individuals to design a game and distribute it, and that stuff will exist if you want it. You know? And...
Yeah. And, I mean, it doesn't mean it's necessarily right, but yeah. I mean, it's just... Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, it's funny. There are actually... further conversations that I think it would be interesting to go down the road on with you, James, but this is technically a family-friendly podcast.
True.
And so I'm going to ask, end there, because, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because now I'm thinking about, like, even more horrifying types of stuff and being like, what if you made a hyper-realistic version of that? It's, oh my gosh, I don't even, okay. I kind of don't even... So the other thing... The thing that's going to allow us to do that, James, because there's a limitation... Did you notice when you were playing VR... This is a neck-breaking transition. But did you notice the quote-unquote screen door effect?
A little bit,
okay.
Well, did I? I noticed a couple jumps at the beginning, but then once I got involved, it wasn't too bad.
Well, because the screen door effect is the where you can little the pixels aren't exactly aligned.
I tried not to look that closely.
I can never notice it. I know that it exists, and on the peripheral, if I really focus on the peripheral of my vision on their headset, like I can notice that I can notice it more distinctly. But you can also see. To me, at least when I was using it, it might have just been it wasn't adjusted properly, but I could see the prism effect of the LEDs were splitting into an array of color around the edges of my eyes. But like you said, once you get into it, you don't really notice it.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it's a problem that they want to fix because some people make a huge deal out of it. Okay. So there's a company that is getting together.
Good life.
I know, right? So one of the big things that people wanted to fix originally was frame rates. They felt like 90 hertz was a bare minimum in order to get a good VR experience.
Okay.
Everybody's got that, so that's not such a huge deal. But getting rid of that, getting the ultra fine detail so you don't get those little
screen
lines,
doors. The
screen door effect, that's all about increasing the pixel density. So there's a company called Japan Display, also known as JDI, has been working to cram more pixels into every inch, resulting in brand new VR tailored screens. The company, which is a joint venture between Sony, Toshiba, Hitachi, is currently developing a 3.42-inch screen that is 1440 pixels by 1700 pixels, packing in a whopping 651 pixels per inch. Yeah, so those are three companies.
So that's a lot, right?
Quite a bit, yeah.
Okay.
So like 400, I think the iPhone,
iPhone
this.
Like 430 or something?
iPhone 7 DPI. I don't want deals. I don't care.
Technical specs.
Canon DPI. Oh. Of course they don't just tell you.
Why yeah, no, you gotta go to like a non-Apple. Display.
So the Galaxy S7 has a 577 DPI. The 4.7 IPS LCD delivers
326,
which is pretty low by these
standards. Yeah,
so they're trying to, right now they're working on something that's doubling that, but their end goal is to get to 800 DPI.
Dang.
Or pixels per inch. Yeah, which is pretty massive pixel density. And the, you know, when Apple came out with their what do they call it? Not Oculus, but their not Aperture. What do they call the screen?
What?
The screen where you couldn't see the pixels anymore. It was the
Retina display.
There, thank you. The Retina display. The whole idea was, at normal user distances, which are 8 inches, the eye can't differentiate individual pixels, right? And so basically this is the same thing, but for VR, where they're saying at normal VR functions, at this pixel, at 800 pixels per inch, you can't differentiate pixels when you're in it, which is pretty impressive.
And did you already say where they're at today?
So most of these companies are around 400.
Okay.
So
double it.
Yeah. So it's a pretty big step to get there, but that's the current current aim. Yeah, pretty ferocious pixel density, and actually,
but like, they've got a working version of it.
They have a working version of the 651, which is pretty good. But 800 is where they're trying to go.
Got it.
And they think that they can get there. Wow. At 90 hertz. So it's, which is interesting because it's not, even at that point, it's not just a matter of getting that many pixels on, getting the pixels that small and that close together, but there's also the issue of just changing that many pixels that quickly.
Yeah.
Like, that becomes a major technological problem for the controller and power consumption and stuff.
Yeah.
So where you'll be able to, you know, ideally they develop these screens and then put them into every cell phone, and then every cell phone can be a super high quality viewer experience. But that's probably a ways off. This is first going to be a stepping stone to your dedicated virtual reality rigs. Yeah,
that would make sense.
Yeah, so pretty cool, though. That's kind of where we're going on that. It's the give it a couple of years, and we'll have some pretty awesome headsets.
Wow. Love it.
Yeah. Also, this week, Google announced that they're trying to ruin everything.
Sometimes that happens.
I know. So they bought the company DeepMind, and they named their like core AI technologies after it. They call it the DeepMind. And so they use DeepMind to learn how to lip read, which, for those of you any familiar with 2001 A Space Odyssey, that should be kind of a horrifying proposition.
Have you seen the latest Villain Pub episode on How It Should Have Ended?
Which one is that one? Is it?
It's literally, they posted it like yesterday or
no,
today.
No, I haven't seen it.
So go to at James Furlow on Twitter. It's my top one right now. It's a link to it.
Yeah.
It's like an 8-minute video for the Villain Pub. It's just Batman finds out where they're all located and fix it. But anyway, but Hal is in it.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's pretty good because he's a villain.
Right, yeah.
Even being a villain, though. Right. But yeah, pretty awesome. I'm sorry I can't do that, Dave.
What?
It's good. Oh, that guy's so good.
I'll watch it right away. But yeah, so basically what happens is lip reading is not actually like lip reading AI. It's not the first time that this has been done. But generally speaking, the place where it was done before was they had people speaking and specific phrases in well lit rooms. So basically saying, hey, can we,
okay,
under ideal conditions, can we do lip reading? And the scientists were able to create a lip reading program called LipNet that achieved 93.4% accuracy in tests, which is
pretty good,
fantastic, compared to the 52% human accuracy. So under ideal conditions, they got, you know, nearly perfect. That being said, so compare this to what DeepMind did. They were only getting 46.8% accuracy with their technique.
Wow.
But that would be compared to 12.4% for professionals. So what they were doing was they took BBC footage and they had it. So they had the AI watching the BBC footage while it was listening to it. So it was transcribing the conversations and then associating those words with the motions that the people were making with their mouth.
Wow.
And then they applied that to to other
Makes
footage.
Sense.
And it was about, they got it right about 50% of the time.
Wow.
Which isn't quite good enough to really follow the conversation.
No.
But it's pretty good. And the amazing part to me here is that it's like their translation software is good enough at this point where they don't even translate it. They just have it translated for themselves.
Which is cool.
Yeah, or transcribe it, I should say.
Right.
Yeah, so this is pretty impressive tech that they've got going on. It's one of those things where they're not specifically saying what they're using it for. They're obviously one of the great places this could be used would be helping hearing impaired people understand conversations, so stuff like that. It could also be used to annotate silent films, which is kind of a small use case. And it can also allow you to control digital assistants like Siri and Alexa by just mouthing words to a camera.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so you wouldn't have to say, I could just go, which was me mouthing the words, okay, Google, and then all of a sudden it picks up and wonders what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. That was the concern about people who are like, well, I don't want to talk to my device in public.
Right.
Problem solved.
Right, you can whisper it quietly and it can just read your mouth.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody's real concern on this is that it'll be used for just reading people's lips when they're on CCTVs and all of a sudden it's bad enough they're reading all your text messages and emails. Now the NSA will be listening to you talk.
Big brother.
Lip reading. One of the optimistic view of this is that that's an incredibly difficult task because CCTVs tend to be
not great footage.
Grainy.
Not even the right angle.
Yeah,
either.
Grainy, poorly lit. It's... Humans have a 0% accuracy with lip reading CCTV, so an AI would have to get significantly better. But this is one of those classic problems where it's like, yeah, okay, it's a problem today, but you know, over time, we now know how to. The problem that has to be fixed is how grainy the CCTVs are, which will happen as things
replace
get
everything with a Nest, and we'll be good to go.
Exactly. So. Yay!
Google's working on both ends.
Yeah, absolutely no way that this could end up being the end of humankind. That's for sure. But this is the other really cool thing, and this is something that I've talked about before. But it's how the language translation works. So Google's Translate is now when you go to their website, it's completely run by their AI, their DeepMind stuff. And Google Translate works with 103 languages, meaning there are 5,253 unique language pairs to be translated, which means that, you know, if you wanted to, how the AI works is you give it a series of sentences in both Japanese and English, and you give it tons and tons and tons of data, you train the AI, and then eventually over time, you can put new phrases in and it'll work out the translation backwards and forwards. The difficulty, that means that every language pair that you want to translate, you have to translate that way, which can be very difficult and time consuming. And so they had this question. It was like, well, if we've got English to Japanese and we've got English to Korean, can we just jump from Japanese to Korean? Do we have to solve them, or can we do this, like, can we do an intermediate language thing?
Like the allocentric map we were talking about.
A little bit.
If you know A to B and B to C, you can figure out A to C.
Exactly. And so they call this the zero-shot translation, and the answer turns out to be yes. And what's really interesting, too, about this is that the computer doesn't, or that... It doesn't necessarily translate Japanese to English and then English to Korean. They let the convolutional neural network do its own thing, and as a result, at the deeper layers, what it is finding are and it's really difficult to describe and even visualize, but basically, this is the easiest way to describe it. It figures out what something means in an abstract way.
Okay.
So what it does is it figures out what the Japanese phrase means and the English phrase means, and it can translate through it. So in Spanish, the word is hermano. In English, the word is brother. When you know those two words, your brain doesn't say, okay, I want to say hermano in Spanish. Hermano is the Spanish version of brother. Your brain just knows what a brother is.
Yeah.
And both of those words are associated with a concept.
It's more of a pinwheel than a daisy chain.
Exactly. And that's what they're finding their convolutional neural network is building, are these pinwheel concepts. You know, for it's very abstract. It doesn't know what a brother is, but it is, there's this abstract idea of brother that is translation, that can be translated in many different languages, and they all sort of point to these collections.
Crazy.
Which, and on one side is really crazy, and on the other side is completely unsurprising, because it's like, what is a neural network? It's a pattern finding machine.
Yep.
It finds super complex patterns out of abstract data, and instead of, yeah, and that's how ended up how its language systems ended up working. So,
got it.
Pretty neat.
Yeah.
And,
I like it.
Yeah. And then, do you want to do the last one? We got time.
We have, sure, why not go for it?
This is interesting, just as a kind of a, I think it'll come up again. Walmart is going to start using the blockchain to track their, what they have in their store. So what the blockchain is,
interesting,
is it's,
I guess that
it's
makes
the
sense.
Backbone of how, Bitcoin was used. So the question was always, well, if you have a Bitcoin, why don't you just copy and paste it? Now you have two Bitcoins. Well, the answer is the blockchain. The blockchain is this distributed database system that allows you to basically say, no, there's only one digital copy of everything. Well, they're associating their digital copy with one actual piece of product. And the reason for it is they find that when they do recalls, they run two risks. One is you don't recall enough and you leave bad food on the shelves, or you recall too much in order to make sure you don't do the first thing and you sort of wasted it. So they want to know, how do we recall just the products that we know are bad? And the only way to do that is to have a database that keeps track of every single product as individual units. And it has to be distributed, and it has to be highly accessible and quick. And so they're basically turning food items into Bitcoins and saying, we can keep track of each individual item of food with a Bitcoin or with the blockchain.
That's smart.
Yeah, it's really smart. And we've talked about how Bitcoin was kind of a fun little experiment, but the exciting part about it is the blockchain. And this is the first giant multinational corporation using it for something other than,
oh my gosh, if it works, everyone's going to copy it.
Oh yeah,
cool.
And it's exactly the sort of thing that Walmart excels at and can and will use and show how it's super profitable, and everybody will be it's getting exciting.
I'm okay with airline industries adopting this strategy as well.
Yeah, for your baggage.
Yeah,
yeah, it'd be pretty nice. A little bit easier than We're barreling down this road. Yeah, just think of mail parcels.
Boom. Yeah.
You know, just keep track. We know where everything is. We get to keep track of it because we know. Yeah. I don't know. Nothing ever gets lost anymore.
We may not know where it is, but it's not lost.
Yeah. cool. So, yeah.
Oh, I love it. Awesome. Cool, man. Well, we're officially into the Christmas season here, so probably a lot less new stuff being released and more about new sales coming out.
Yeah.
But it's exciting. Very cool. Oh, man. Well,
this ended up being a two-hour interesting show. I did not expect that.
There you go.
20 minutes before we started the show.
that's super true. Well, I guess I'm going to put you on the spot here. I'm going to ask you what you're thankful for as we wrap up the show. So I guess for myself, in addition to being thankful that you joined us and made it this far through the show, episode 270, by the way, and letting you know how much we really do appreciate it. I'm thankful that we live in a time and age where a lot of peaks have been found, and it seems that we're climbing up them faster.
Yeah.
It's a super interesting time. I think it'll be, ultimately even more interesting 50 years from now. But that's okay. I'm still thankful that we're getting to see a lot of this foundational digital tech being created.
Right.
It probably feels the same way for like back when like electricity and things and were coming on board. You know, even that's foundational of what we're looking at now, right? And
right.
Just like, whoa, check it out. I lit up the street. My house is lit up. You know what I mean? Like,
right, yeah.
And now we're like, we got Christmas colors that we did by voice. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So anyways, thankful for that. How about you?
Yeah, I would say as amazing as video calling is and how great it is to be, to be able to be connected with people that are far away, it's always nice to actually be able mm-hmm. to hang out with people in person, and this has just been a very good week for getting to spend time with the people I care about, not just you, James.
That's cool.
But
my daughter, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm thankful that we were able to do this and do the show live and get to hang out with I've had a very good week of spending time with important people. So
excellent. Cool. Glad to hear it. Well, everybody, on that note, thanks again for listening. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes at furloughrose.com, episode 270. If you'd like them sent to your inbox, you can do that too. It's on the right-hand side of the page. And then finally, we just want to let you know that this podcast is supported generously by listeners just like you. And if you'd like to also contribute, you can. That's also on the website for you to find out how you can become a patron. We would love it if you get on the team. And with that, I am James Furlough, and my 40-pound brother is Matthew Furlough, and we will talk next time. Thank you.